little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. On this edition of Conversations, we'll talk with Dr. Harumi Befu. He says a superficial understanding of culture can be worse than no understanding at all. I'm Susan McInnes. Welcome to Conversations, and welcome, Dr. Befu.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I want to take an example from a paper you wrote as a way of starting this discussion. Sure. You said that in Japan, a Japanese person might invite you to dinner, and may or may not mean that invitation. Is that something like me saying to you, Harumi, drop by any time, you're always welcome, my house is your house?
Yes, it's very similar to that. I think every culture or every language and culture in combination has a way of conveying messages in different levels. And when we live in a certain culture, we are aware of these multiple levels of conversation, communication, and we can sort out the meanings. When we go abroad and start speaking in a different language that you learned as an adult and have an incomplete understanding of the language, then the different layers of meaning become obliterated, or you don't understand some of the deeper levels, and you act on the basis only of the superficial level, the first meaning, or direct translation, so to speak, and act on the basis of that. That creates a misunderstanding very often. So it can happen here, too. I recall a case of a Japanese man who came to this country. This was in the 60s, and still there weren't very many Japanese in this country. His English wasn't very good, and he dated an American girl. And everything went very well, and so they dated a couple more times, and as they were leaving, the girl said, well, why don't you give me a ring this Friday? And he thought, well, does she really mean engagement?
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So, see, there are misunderstandings of that sort.
Could I insult a polite person by accepting a dinner invitation and showing up?
You would fluster the person. You wouldn't insult the person.
Yeah. Okay.
But the Japanese, too, do know that the foreigners have an incomplete understanding of Japanese culture. They make allowance for it, and they may be flustered, but they would not be angry. If a Japanese were so forward as to accept the invitation when it wasn't meant to be an invitation, then the person would be either angry or the person would ridicule the other Japanese for not understanding the real meaning.
And certainly remember not to do that again.
Of course.
If I said drop by any time and you did.
Yes.
Right.
Our guest will find out.
Go ahead.
If you accepted the invitation when it wasn't meant to be, by the way that you'll be treated at the dinner.
Yes. All right. Probably as a stranger. On this edition of Conversations, we're taking a look at communication across cultures. Dr. Harumi Befu is an American anthropologist. He was born in the United States and has been living in the United States for, permanently since 1947, yes?
Yes.
A good long time. He is a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and has been studying and writing extensively on these issues of communicating across cultures. If I were to, as an American, want to have greater interaction with you, I might invite you home.
Mm-hmm.
And if I did and you walked in and said, wow, nice house, I'd probably offer you the nickel tour, to show you around. My understanding is this is very different in Japan. How so?
That's right. Yes. Americans have a very open attitude toward foreigners, toward strangers, outsiders, much more so than the Japanese. So that when a guest comes, that you are more likely to show different parts of the house. Be proud of your house, too. In Japan, there is a sharper distinction between made between an outsider and the family members. And this is indicated by the fact that the outsiders, guests, are brought into the house if they are, and they are shown to a guest room, a specially appointed room for guests. And usually they just stay there. If they have to go to a bathroom, they are shown where the bathroom is. But otherwise, the person would not be shown around the house.
Mm-hmm.
There is a much greater sense of privacy that the Japanese indicate or symbolize in terms of the home life as against what goes on outside. And there are verbal cues for this. There are Japanese terms that use the term uchi versus soto. And uchi means inside in the first meaning of the word, but also it means family. And soto means outside, but also it means outsiders, strangers.
Mm-hmm. We have those kinds of divisions, but they're not necessarily centered around the home, although as you speak, I think in some ways they are as well, but the home may be more negotiable in
That's right.
for an American than for a Japanese.
Yes, and one expression of that is that we do home entertainment quite often for your friends and colleagues, whereas in Japan this is extremely rare, home is reserved for your family, your relatives, and very close friends. A person would invite his subordinates home on special occasions, New Year's Day, for example. This is the day of a special occasion. And so it's a formalized kind of invitation.
But that would mean something about the subordinate.
Yes.
It would be an embrace
That's
in some
right.
ways.
Yes, and
see.
It's a privileged invitation.
Mm.
If a subordinate has a personal problem having to do with his family, children, then he might want to discuss this matter at his home, or he would invite his subordinate to his home to discuss this private matter. And again, this is a very privileged kind of relationship and situation.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, Japanese do entertainment outside, in the restaurants and the bars and clubs and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If there were 5 or 6 of us at a dinner party, either at a restaurant or at our home, I would expect that the conversation, an American-style conversation, would focus on one topic or another, and the whole group would be connected. But there might also be side discussions. One
mm-hmm.
or two people might break off from the discussion, the main discussion, and then come back.
Is this
also logical in Japan, mm-hmm. that we would have more than one conversation going on among a small group of people?
If the group is large, then that is likely to happen in Japan too.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a small group, like 5 or 6 or even 7 or 8, then the conversation tends to focus on a single topic, centered around the key guest of the party. That person, whoever it is, has a privileged position in the party setting. And so people make sure that they will pay attention to him, pay respect to what he has to say, and make sure that his position of honor is not violated.
Uh-huh.
And that is very important. The people are constantly and keenly aware of the relative status and positions in this kind of interactive setting.
With a kind of conscious egalitarianism among Americans, we would probably try to make the person welcome by diminishing that status, making
mm-hmm.
not insulting by any means, but
yes.
making that person just
right.
one of the group.
Exactly.
Very
and
different.
You adopt first name. For
uh-huh. yes. Right. That makes sense.
That's right. Whereas in Japan, the use of the honorific titles in a private setting is very common, so that let's say a department head in a private party setting at dinner is still called a department head rather than as Mr. Tanaka.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
This is now slowly breaking down. Some companies are beginning to institute a new practice where such titles are not to be used, but still this is in a minority. And most of the companies still maintain the hierarchy and maintain the conscious representation of a hierarchy.
Dr. Harumi Befu is our guest on this edition of Conversations. We're taking a look at cultural differences. I think this question is too large, so if you could just kind of address whatever part of it makes sense. How do these social conventions, what do these social conventions, rather, tell an outsider about how a Japanese person perceives him or herself, or how the Japanese culture perceives itself? Is that an answerable opening?
Could you put that in a little bit more specific context?
Well, you were saying that for example, if a special guest was invited to dinner, or if the department head was invited, that person would have a particular status. It seemed, and in America, that status would be different because we see ourselves differently. As say, that was my thought. We see ourselves as more egalitarian, so we would hope to communicate that everyone being equal over the dinner table.
That's right.
In Japanese society, this is more hierarchical. Status has a greater meaning or a different meaning?
Yes, so it's a very interesting question, a complicated question. There's an interesting book and a not quite a bestseller, but a book that's sold very, has been cited and quoted very, very often. It's a book by an anthropologist by the name of Chie Nakane, and the book is titled Japanese Society. And the major thesis of this book is Japanese society is hierarchically arranged, and the people are stacked up and one on top of another. And so she contrasts this with the Western society where the relationship is more egalitarian, as you are saying. Now, there is an element of this, definitely, no question about it. On the other hand, we also have to be aware that although we try to create an egalitarian setting in interactive relationships, we are aware that we are not equal. The professors, when the professor interacts with the students, often the graduate students call professors by first name, and we accept that, and we don't feel any sort of a relationship, the authority relationship is violated. On the other hand, the student knows that they are being judged. They are going to be judged until they get their degrees. Creation of the egalitarian atmosphere is sometimes a facade. And again, we are operating in double layers here. On the one hand, we are aware that there is hierarchy. On the other hand, we want to act as if we are all equal. So we have to be aware of that kind of a complication. To take another kind of a example, whereas in Japan this hierarchy is greatly emphasized, especially in a work setting, company setting, as I was discussing. On the other hand, if you look at the salary differentials between the person with the lowest salary in a company and a company president, the differential is a fraction of the differential between an IBM CEO and the person who gets the lowest salary at IBM. And that goes true for many other companies in Japan. In other words, having earning so many more times the salary of a secretary is not the way that the person's worth is adjudged. In this country, again, in big companies, the CEOs have special parking spaces right near the entrance. In Japan, there's no such practice. And everybody has equal chance of opportunity of dashing to the closest parking space. Another example would be the cafeteria. Everybody eats in the same cafeteria, whatever title you have. Whereas in American companies, the executives have their own dining room, and workers eat in another place. In Japan, when workers come to work, they wear a uniform. They take off their jacket, and there is a special company uniform they wear. Everybody wears this. Mm. So there is a facade of egalitarianism that's created. So if you look at these examples, see, then the difference between America and Japan is not as stark as you thought it would be. It isn't the difference between Japan being strictly hierarchical, America being strictly egalitarian.
Yes.
Both societies contain both elements, and both societies try to provide egalitarian settings, but also they have to deal with the reality that a company is a hierarchical organization.
Mm-hmm. These are fascinating differences and similarities.
Yes,
certainly. Dr. Harumi Befu on this edition of Conversations. I'll take just a moment to introduce the professor and our guest today a little more fully. Again, he is an anthropologist. Among his writings, which focus on Japan, theories of social exchange as applied to Japan, the challenge of Japan's internationalization, organization, and culture about the changing economy in Japan, an anthropological introduction called Japan, An Anthropological Introduction, was your first book, yes, in 1971?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's also written extensively on gift-giving and reciprocity. The first topic we picked up today was from a paper called An Ethnography of Dinner Entertainment in Japan. Dr. Harumi Befu on this edition of Conversations. This perhaps is only a slight move from this last discussion. It seems to me that internal perceptions, that is how Americans perceive themselves and how we're perceived outside, are very different.
Mm-hmm.
Do you sense that there is the same rift between how Japanese perceive Japanese and how, let's say, the Western world, just kind of pick a part of the world, perceives the Japanese?
Mm-hmm.
And does that cause any distress in Japan, as it sometimes does in America?
Yes, it certainly does. And this inside view and an outside view are different, definitely, and seem to be totally different, and yet they do interact. And again, it's a more complicated issue than what it seems on the surface. Japanese are very keenly interested in who they are. They have been for past 150 years or longer, partly because Japan has been basically a receiver of the benefits of civilization, first from China, mm-hmm. and then later from the West, Europe first, and then from the United States. And Japan has regarded as a student having to learn these things, and looked upon China as a Japan's teacher, looked upon Europe as Japan's teacher, and now the United States as its teacher. And Japan wants to be a good student and wants to present a certain perspective of themselves toward outsiders, particularly to the teachers. They want to represent themselves as good students on the whole. The views presented to outsiders by Japanese, especially the intellectuals, nowadays tend to show Japanese as being self-confident and having exploited their tradition to achieve the current economic success. Their family institution, their values, their religions, these all came together to create the kind of economic institution which was so successful in the world scene. Mm-hmm. Now, foreigners look at Japan has a different agenda in creating this image. They want to see them see Japan vis-a-vis themselves and trying to create Japan as an image which is the opposite of their own. The West is one thing, the East is different, foreign, and opposite of the West. Well, East and the West are opposite, I suppose, in terms of orientation, cardinal orientation, and in terms of cultural thinking, too. They tend to be regarded as being opposite. So Americans are individualistic. Then the Japanese are not. And what are they? They are group-oriented, group-minded. And Japanese insist on the, on self-righteousness, their own privacy, individual rights, and Japanese tend to obliterate these individual rights, and they tend to be more concerned with the family, the group, the company, and they sacrifice themselves for these things. Mm-hmm. And Americans have individuality. Japanese are void of individuality. At worst, Japanese are robots, just acting at the dictate of the group norm. And Americans would never do that. So Americans try to create an image of Japan which is opposite of their own. And in that process, naturally, since nobody wants to think of themselves as unworthy, you think of yourself as worthy, then the opposite of that is rather unworthy. And in American frame of mind, to be called, you don't have individuality, or you are just following the dictates of the group, is really an insult.
Sheep.
Yes.
Lemming.
Exactly.
These are not words we value.
No.
No.
And that's what they are.
Yes.
See?
Yeah. A lot of this is ignorance from your perspective. I don't mean to say a lot of these prejudices are born of not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, of course it comes from ignorance too, but also it comes from our larger issues of geopolitics and geoeconomics. Mm-hmm. And currently in Japan and the United States are battling over the trade issues and have been for the last 15, 20 years. And the government officials, politicians, and the economic tycoons, these people want to advance and promote their own interests. In doing so, then, they create these images mm-hmm. of bad Japan, and good America. And we have to distinguish that from ordinary, common people, their thinking about each other. Whereas there are many Japanese businessmen and politicians who badmouth America, if you take the ordinary people, young people, they have nothing particularly bad to say about America. Of course, they are afraid of all the crimes and whatnot, but they are enamored by Hollywood, American music, mm-hmm. And American folk culture. And that love of America, American culture, is not going to be destroyed by these politicians pontificating their own personal views. Mm-hmm. So we need to be cognizant of these different levels of the images of each other.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that briefly, and I guess I just want to give some sense of equal time to this, that the Japanese government and corporate structure has also been kind of blindly critical of Americans, as well as the American press and political and corporate structure looking at Japanese as kind of devil incarnate. We do this peculiar thing with each other.
Yeah. It is mutual, and that we should never think that it's all Japan's fault or all America's fault. Mm-hmm. They're doing it to each other. Mm-hmm. This is something that we tend to slight, if not forget. Because we have, as Americans, have vested interest in America, it's easier for us to forget that we are doing bad things, and we tend to see faults in Japan, in other countries. But the Japanese could count as many faults in America as Americans could count faults in Japanese.
Yeah.
There's an interesting book by John Dower called War Without Mercy. And this is an account of the ways in which America depicted Japan during the Second World War, mm-hmm. and also the way Japan depicted America during the Second World War. Uh-huh. And he's very even-handed, and he shows that both of them were doing the same thing. Neither side can be regarded anywhere near a saint in the fighting a war. Both of them are creating an image of each other as ogres, as demons.
Yes. Someone in our audience may want to write that down. His name again and the book's title?
John Dower.
Dower?
D-O-W-E-R.
Uh-huh.
And the name of the book is War Without Mercy.
Good. Thank you. Yes. On this edition of Conversations, we're taking a look at cultural perceptions, and our focus is Japan, by virtue of the fact that our guest today is an anthropologist whose major focus is Japanese studies. Dr. Harumi Befo is a professor of anthropology at Stanford University. His education, bachelor's in anthropology from UCLA, his master's from the University of Michigan was in Far Eastern studies, and his PhD from the University of Wisconsin in anthropology. He, before taking his position at Stanford, taught as well at the universities of Nevada, Missouri, and Michigan. You've been with Stanford how long?
Since 1965.
Our guest on this edition of Conversations, Dr. Harumi Befo. I'm Susan McGinnis. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yes. Let's continue in this realm for a moment and kind of look at the ways we grapple with each other, and maybe we can go on in a bit and talk about ways we can overcome this, mm-hmm. these myths and peculiar perceptions. I guess I want to return to World War II in a moment, but I keep remembering an image of Detroit auto workers furious with, and I can't remember whether it's Toyota or what automaker it was, for in their belief, quote, taking our jobs. Mm-hmm. So furious that a Toyota was smashed to death. I mean, it was just ripped apart by the sledgehammers.
That's
and the
right.
like.
I think each one paid $1
for the
privilege.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Yeah. This is fairly extreme, but it certainly shows that this fury about one's own situation directed outward towards someone else as the enemy.
Yes. An interesting thing about that is when Japanese automakers began to build assembly plants in the United States, and by now all five automakers have assembly plants either in the United States or in Canada, most of them in the United States. Mm-hmm. When this was taking place, Japanese never said, Americans are taking our jobs away. It was a very interesting contrast.
Why not?
Their view was that this was a corporate decision on the part of the Japanese automakers, and that they were doing this out of necessity, and necessity coming, one, from the gradual rise in the wages on the part of the Japanese workers, and it was becoming competitive to build plants here and pay auto workers in this country and produce cars here. Second, because the local content law that the United States passed, which required a Japanese automobile to have a certain percentages of parts built in and purchased in this country. And so Japanese understood this was a necessity imposed by outside forces. So they did not respond or react in the same way that Americans did.
This speaks of a very different relationship with one's employer than we have in the United States.
Yes.
Your example shows that the Japanese worker trusted his or her employer to be doing the best for the company and thus for him or herself.
Well, yes, it's not just the employees, but also Japanese public in general. Mm-hmm. What we found in this country is that there was almost a public outcry, and even the politicians in Washington would say that the foreign countries are taking jobs away from us.
Mm-hmm.
You did not hear that from Japanese politicians. The workers themselves were very sorry that their jobs were taken away. It wasn't a happy situation. But also there's another factor involved here. In Japan, these large companies, including all of the automakers, have the policy of what is called a permanent employment, where these auto workers are assured of a position. And even if assembly plant is disassembled, removed, taken abroad, the company will not fire these people. One way or another, these people are kept on payroll. And they don't have to fear that their livelihood is immediately at stake, as it would be in this country.
This is not simply a generosity of spirit. They're looked after.
That's right.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. How they deal with this problem is a very complicated but also an interesting issue. Japanese companies have banked on the high morale and productivity resulting from the high morale coming from this the promise of permanent employment at a considerably high cost, a cost that American companies would not bear. And of course, the economic structure and employment structure in the United States are not geared for a permanent employment,
right.
So that it would not work even if they tried to do that in the United States.
What's the practical advantage or the philosophical advantage of employing me from the time I come out of college until I retire? What kind of an employee are they creating by giving me this?
There are many. First of all, preamble, I guess I should add that this system doesn't apply to all Japanese workers. It applies only to the elite workers in big companies.
And parenthetically, it wouldn't apply to a woman, probably.
It's a yes and no kind of a situation.
Okay.
It does, in theory, but the company puts pressure on women not to stay on the job until 55, 65.
Okay. I knew as soon as I said it, it was a poor example. But yeah.
No, it isn't. And that's because Japanese companies have placed women in menial jobs, and menial jobs can be done with a person with very little training, and skill levels do not improve so much with so many years of experience.
Right.
And so, but the salary has to increase as time goes. So Japanese companies have decided it's best to recycle women workers, that is, retire the older ones and bring in younger ones fresh out of school and pay lower salaries.
Yeah.
If this system has changed, and if women are moved into career positions, in management positions, then I'm sure that Japanese companies will be motivated to keep women workers because their value is going to increase with time. Unfortunately, currently the gender hierarchy is rather firmly entrenched in the employment situation.
Yes.
But this is changing too. Yeah. Well, anyway, that was the preamble.
Thank you.
Number of people who can be employed in this permanent employment situation is relatively small, and they come from prestige schools, and only the graduates of elite schools are hired in these positions. Naturally, these people are well-educated and highly talented people to start with. Mm-hmm. The company then is able to keep these people and train them for leadership positions. It behooves them to keep them because these people are very talented people. So there's reason for exercising this permanent employment. And as I said, that there is very high morale that develops among these people because you don't have to be worried that you might be laid off tomorrow or next week. Mm-hmm. And you are assured that you're going to be on the payroll. And you are assured that the person next working next to you is also going to be staying with the company until he or she retires, more likely he. You develop then a close relationship with the co-workers. You don't have to think that, my relationship with this person may last only 6 months, only a year. You never know. So why bother investing time in developing relationship with your co-worker? They know that it is worthwhile to invest your time and effort in developing relationship. Mm-hmm. Also, the peculiarity of the Japanese social structure is that the people do place value in mutual reciprocity of gives and takes, people do depend on one another for both emotionally and materially. If you don't do your work, then somebody else has to cover you, and that's your co-worker, and it's a person that you're going to live with for the next 20 years. You cannot afford to put burden on this person when you have this strong relationship, you could do it too if you tried harder. So this kind of a feeling of a mutual expectation, obligation, relationship then creates a synergy that you wouldn't find in the United States, where people are always thinking of themselves, their own self-interest, worrying about the next job that they may have to look for in another company.
I think that's maybe true, especially in our current economic climate in large institutions. In smaller ones, my sense is that people are in the United States more focused on the group. Mm-hmm. Less selfish than it might appear. But I'm interested in your example as something that seems to not only reinforce but continually recreate the importance of the community to the individual.
That's right.
So that with every task you do, you're committing yourself further to the group rather than committing yourself to your own.
That's right.
Next step.
Yes. That's a very important point. Every day of cooperation with another person reinforces the relationship. We should not look upon this as a kind of an idyllic utopia. There is a price, and very often high price, that the individuals have to pay. If I want to take off for a family vacation, then I know that you would have to cover for me, and you would have to work extra hard. Maybe you have to put in 2 hours of overtime. And I know that's a burden on you, and that feeling then prevents me from frivolously taking time off. And often, even if the company allows 2 weeks of family paid vacation, I feel constrained from taking my time off.
Yes.
And so
it's not something you earn and feel is yours.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yes. Tell me how this situation, if it is, changing. The biggest employers long-term in Japan have been in steel and auto and textiles and
electronics.
Electronics is still emerging, but mm-hmm. like in the United States, textiles and steel and mm-hmm. autos are in
shipping.
Decline for very
yes.
in shipping
yes.
for various reasons. Mm-hmm. Is the permanent promise of permanent employment being shaken? And if it's being mm-hmm. shaken, is it then shaking group cohesion? Or is that a logical step?
No, I think that's a very good question, and it's a question that the Japanese executives are having to face, and that they are groping for answers. The clear-cut answer has not come forth as yet. And in the meantime, companies are trying out many different things to deal with this issue. The problem arises from many different factors. And one is, as you're saying, that some of the industries are permanently in the decline, and the large labor force that a company hired at the peak of the industry is still with them on the payroll, and because of the permanent employment, the company cannot easily dismiss them. Added to this is the current high cost of yen compared with the dollar, mm-hmm. Which is making products produced in Japan less competitive in the international market. So Japan is more and more outsourcing the materials rather than creating materials on their own at home. Mm-hmm. Also, they are shipping out their plants, assembly plants, abroad where the labor is cheap, particularly in the Southeast Asia.
These two or three trends are leaving people standing in their factories and
yes,
offices.
That's right. And so that is the worry of the executives in Japanese companies, what to do with these people. So in the short run, then they have to deal with these people. In the long run, they are trying to reduce the size of the permanent workforce, not to hire as many college graduate on the permanent employment basis as they used to. So that even with the declining industry, they would be able to deal with this slimmed down permanent workforce without having to keep them half unemployed. And this is a huge issue. That is there is something called hidden unemployment. It's a category that is that the labor economists deal with in Japan. These are the people who are on the payroll in a company because they are in a permanent employment, but they do not have work, or they don't work full time. They work less than full time, and yet so on the surface it looks like these people are employed and do not appear in the unemployment statistics. But in reality, these people are working half time or less than half time, and so if you add these people to, and there are estimates of how many people are in this hidden unemployment, the actual statistics on unemployment will go up a couple of percentage points.
I'm interested in the impact on the worker. Mm-hmm. If a person's role has been to contribute to the group mm-hmm. and to be a participant so that we are all equally carrying the weight of our business, mm-hmm. what does it feel like to sit and look out the window or to read a paper when there are people working? Is that...
That's right. Yes, it's a serious morale problem. And so the company tries its best not to produce that kind of a situation where you have workers who are idling. And one of, for example, one of the things the company does is to send its excess workers to subsidiaries, subcontractors. When this happens, these people are still on the payroll of the company that they had been working for, but in effect, they go to a subsidiary to work. Usually, subsidiaries have a pay scale which is somewhat lower than these big companies, and that's one of the reasons why people want to work for big companies.
Right.
But the company promises the same pay scale, and they do that by paying this additional percentage out of its own coffer, so that the smaller subsidiary will pay what is appropriate according to its pay scale, and if there is a 15% differential, the big company will pay the 15%.
You don't lose status. You don't lose practical employment,
exactly.
And you maintain your pay.
That's right.
Are these issues nonetheless unsettling to the Japanese population?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking again of our own country. In the United States, since things began to falter, even when the economy, by all statistics, is doing well, we are likely to be described as nervous workers across the board, from Fairbanks to New York City and south. Is this similar in Japan from, again, an anthropologist's perspective?
It is similar.
Yeah.
Now, looking at it purely objectively in a national comparison, you might say, well, you're still assured of your salary. Wow, what's the worry? From an American auto worker's perspective, that's really a tremendous privilege. Am I going to sit at home and still draw a salary? Well, that's fine. You might say that. But from the perspective of the Japanese, it's really a devastating, almost as devastating as being laid off. When Toyota announced that it would close its plant in near the city of Toyota, where Toyota Auto Company started, and move it to southern part of Japan, where the labor is cheaper and so forth, the auto workers were very angry. They were told that their position is assured, but they never dreamt that they would have to be, for example, transferred to another a plant in Kyushu or having to work for a subsidiary. And the psychologically, the amount of upset that these people felt is almost as much as a Detroit worker was laid off.
Yeah.
Yes.
What we have, unfortunately, about 10 minutes left. What's your sense of the long term? These economics and management shifts and shakeups will continue.
Yes.
Japan has long been a fairly flexible culture. Will it flex? Will it adapt and have a strong economy and strong cultural ties as well?
I'm fairly optimistic about that. I don't think that Japan will. Japanese economy will decline because they are stuck with a certain employment structure or business practices. I think they will rebound and be able to meet the challenging competition in the international scene. And they will do that in this particular example that we are pursuing, as I said, by slimming down the permanent workforce and by having contractors, subcontractors do the jobs that the permanent workers were doing in the past. But the decision-making structure, the management structure, top leadership, these will be reserved to the small core of permanent employees. and all companies are moving in that direction. At the same time, college graduates should not assume that if they are employed by a big company, they are going to be able to stay with that company forever. They may be outplaced to another company, even though they may be able to carry the badge of the parent company.
Yeah.
And that's a fate that they have to be aware of.
We've, in this country, made that shift in less than a generation, of the assumption that I think a generation ago it was assumed that a man would work in the same kind of business all his life.
Mm-hmm.
They say now that we'll change not just employers, but we can change professions
that's
up to
right.
five or six times in a lifetime.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's right. The same sort of thing is happening in Japan, and these people are having to cope with it. And I think younger people, the college students, the people who have graduated from college in the last 5-10 years, these people, an increasing number of these people are saying, I don't want to work for a big company anymore. Or I don't feel like I should be stuck with one company forever.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do what I want to do. And I would rather work for a small company and do what I want to do.
Yeah.
So I think that the mentality of the younger people, the attitude of the younger workers, are also changing in this new direction. So that flexing for the new situation is going to come about less painfully than we think.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if this isn't an impact of, for both East and West, an internationalization. We are not necessarily moving closer to each other culturally, but we're impacting each other.
Oh, definitely.
On both sides.
Yes.
This we may not have enough time to treat this anywhere near well, but I'm looking again as a culture watcher for your thinking on whether and how the United States, probably more importantly, how the United States and Japan will work out this periodic flash rage enmity we have towards each other. A lot of it's based in World War II,
mm-hmm.
On both sides.
Yes.
A lot of it's based in the impact of multinationals on both sides,
mm-hmm.
and economic and cultural change on both sides.
Yes.
Those seem to be where the foundation problems exist. What's your sense of what it will take for us to understand each other better as people rather than as opposing forces?
Yeah, and that's a good point. There are these two levels, the people's level and these political and economic forces. There are people like Huntington who think that there is going to be this clash of civilization,
yeah.
The battling out of the supremacy in the world economy. I think that's rather too dramatic. I don't think it's going to be like that in the future. There are going to be continued confrontations in the future, challenges toward each other. But there will be also a continued uneasy accommodation for one another. I doubt that there's going to be an open outbreak of hostility. And the relationship will continue to be, on the whole, positive rather than negative.
Mm-hmm.
But each side probably will be acting hawkishly from time to time, almost inevitable in the because politicians have to satisfy their own domestic constituency, and which has nothing to do with broader international issues. In order to please your own constituency, you have to beat your chest. unfortunately has international repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
At another level, as I said, the younger people and ordinary people will continue to appreciate each other. Americans too, ordinary people have plenty of appreciation toward Japanese culture. Of course, there are some Americans who have racist attitudes, but on the whole, there is a positive, friendly understanding and appreciation of one another. Mm-hmm. And I think that will continue and grow because the communication and transportation, these things are going to increase. There are going to be more people visiting back and forth, reading about each other, seeing each other in the television and so forth. And inevitably, that is going to create more understanding. Of course, it will create a misunderstanding too, but I think positive, correct, accurate understanding of each other is going to outweigh misunderstanding. Yeah. So I have a more optimistic view of the future.
On a one-to-one level is, and this takes us back to our the lightest part of our discussion, matters of etiquette, is the best thing to do to remember that whichever culture it is, our own culture is complex and many-layered, and mm-hmm. so is this other culture that we are looking at?
That's right, yes. I think you put it right. I think first you have to appreciate your own culture and how complex it is. And we often forget to do that because we are like fish in water.
Yes.
But water is made up of many different chemicals, and we have to understand that. And once you do that and assume that the other cultures are just as complex, then I think we're getting somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dr. Befu, I meant to ask you about this earlier, but in the few seconds, minutes, whatever it is we have left, I do want to ask you about it. You're here in Alaska to talk to the Japanese Language Department here at this university and Foreign Language Department down at UAA in an effort to promote Asian studies.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those awful in a minute or less discussions, but why at this time? Why do you feel it's so important to create Asian studies departments around this nation?
Yeah. Well, speaking specifically about Alaska, Japan's relationship with Alaska is extremely important for Alaska's own economic survival. The amount of trade between Japan and Alaska is greater than with any other country.
Mm-hmm.
And this trade relationship is likely to continue and even grow. Understanding Japan, therefore, is going to be critical for Alaska's survival. And it's not just a trade, but also you're going to have, along with the trade, businessmen coming, the tourists coming, and Alaskans will have to directly interface with the Japanese. In that kind of a situation, you don't want to create a misunderstanding, difficulty, and bashing each other. So that you end up having kind of a problems that we have seen in Lower 48 with regard to the treatment of not only Japanese but Chinese and Southeast Asians in various parts of the country.
The reality is changing our life, and so our lives must change with this new reality.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dr. Harumi Befu, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Once again, Dr. Befu is a professor of anthropology at Stanford University. He is in Fairbanks under the auspices of the Association for Asian Studies, once again to assist the development of Asian Studies programs in Alaska and to lecture at this university as well as at UAA. I'm Susan McGinnis. I'm glad you could join us today, and I hope you join me again next week. And thank you again, Dr. Befu.
Thank you very much.